Welcome to The Bottom Line. I'm Doug Wells, and today we are speaking with Alan Martin, founder and CEO of Campus Book Rentals. Alan's company has been called the Netflix for college textbooks. If you're not a starving college student, though, you may not have heard of them. But this Utah company has rented over 1 million textbooks and was ranked number 17 on Inc. magazine's list of the fastest-growing privately held companies in America. Alan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So I was somewhat surprised when I did a little background research on just the size of the U.S. textbook industry. I had no idea American kids were spending so much each year to buy their textbooks. What's the size of that industry, and how much is purchased versus rented?
It is big. It's a quiet industry, and it's private, so it's not easy to get at numbers. But there's about $10 billion going through the higher education market each year just on textbooks. And today, could be as high as 25% of the books that move through the system are rented. It was 0% back in 2007. So to see, you know, a fifth or a quarter today is just a huge shift.
Which is probably a good number for you, right, at 20%, because if it was 80%, you'd pretty much be capped out.
Exactly, right? Yeah. We wouldn't have a long ways to go here. But, you know, fairly young, but it's substantial, and I think it's really proven itself, you know, for something to grow that much in that shorter period of time. You know, the rental product has really proven itself.
Right. And what does the average college student spend a year for his textbooks if he were to buy them?
Oh, average about $1,000 for a full-time student if they're to buy. So.
And how about if they were to rent those same books?
Basically cut that price in half. Now, students are going to come and rent, and a lot of them are going to find books for 80 or 90% less than they would be if they bought them. But on average, given that some are going to be a little more, some are going to be a little bit less, students can just count on saving at least 50% by renting.
Okay. And I kind of jumped into a little bit about the industry, but I want to take a step back and give you a chance to tell our audience your name's descriptive, Campus. Campus Book Rentals.
Yeah.
But yet, tell us a little bit about your business. What do you guys do?
So when we started, you know, I was in college still back in 2007. I had graduated with my undergrad. I was in the master's program at this point. And, you know, I had been buying and selling my textbooks for basically 5 years outside of the bookstore. And I just noticed, holy cow, I'm breaking even when I buy and sell these things, you know, semester after semester.
Only because you were smart, right? You were buying your books when other people were selling, and probably the reverse, right?
Or poor. Right. Something, yeah.
You were motivated either way.
I was motivated. Right. I was compelled to do this. And, you know, I thought, you know, if you could buy and sell on a national level and essentially break even, why couldn't you rent a book in between these two activities? Why wouldn't that work? And dug as deep as I could, and it looked like it wasn't happening. So we started by just renting textbooks to students. You know, that was campusbookrentals.com. That's where the name came from. That was what our expertise was early on. And we have, you know, metamorphosized the business in a lot of ways. Now we provide a lot of different technologies to the college retail industry. But starting out, and still our biggest focus is, you know, driving down the cost of textbooks and doing that through rental to students.
You know, the rental industry, the business model there is actually quite interesting because, like you said, it's pretty high margin because you can buy textbooks at a lower cost than a college student can buy them because you're buying them in volume. And just like any rental business, whether you're renting skis or renting a car or renting textbooks, like you said, if you do it right, you can probably get what you paid for it on the back end. But the challenge with the rental industry is it takes a tremendous amount of money to grow. The good news, the more people use your service, that's great. Your revenues are high. But it also means you got to come out of pocket for that $100 textbook that somebody's going to pay you $20, $30 for. So how did you fund that cash flows in the early days?
Yeah, it is challenging, especially for something like this, because students were coming at us very rapidly. They wanted the service. They were able to keep their money in their pocket up front. So rental was very appealing to the student. For us, it was very painful because that did take a lot of capital.
Were you surprised by this, or did you know that going in?
No, we know.
You
knew
it going in.
Yeah,
okay.
we had run the math, and it was pretty clear this was going to be the case. So I, you know, I ended up quitting my job in February of 2008 and dropping out of the master's program. And at that point in time, it became pretty important to find some capital. So, you know, in the earliest days, me and the friends that were around me who were business partners as well, we basically just started saving credit card offers. You know, this is spring of 2007. You got an offer every other day in the mail.
This is what guys like me tell you not to do,
yeah,
right?
Totally. Yeah. And the things that my parents told me not to do as well. So usually those would end up in the garbage can or the recycle pile. But, you know, we started saving those. And we ended up submitting most of those at about the same time, hoping we could generate some business. We ended up raising about $250,000 on credit cards.
And you say raising, right?
But I know. I use that term loosely a little bit, but we
borrowing. You know, really?
We borrowed $250,000 from credit card companies
at 20%, 25% a year. This is expensive.
Yeah, we had a plan. A lot of them. This is still again early 2008. Companies were eager to get folks in my demographic onto their system, and so a lot of them were interest-free for the first year. So our plan was, let's get this credit, let's use it, build the textbook asset, and let's get these paid off as soon as we can. And there were some home lines of credit in there as well, but altogether, it over $250,000. And that's how we started out early on. That funded the business through 2008. It continued to be, capital intensive, and we knew this, and there was so much demand for the product, it kept growing. Ultimately, we became profitable in 2009, and we ultimately raised some venture capital.
So we need to give a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. This is not for amateurs. This is a very high risk approach.
It was
worked out really well for you. Unfortunately, 80% of companies like yours, don't make it. Good people, good ideas, work hard, but don't make it. And that's why that approach can be risky. It worked out really well for you. What did your wife, not only did you rack up credit card debt, but you had a nice job. You were working as a civilian for the Air Force as a professional negotiator.
Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty stable, secure job. You gave that up. You dropped out of your school. So you were all in. Really risky. What did your parents think of this? What did your friends think of this? And you were married at the time. What was your wife saying during all of this?
Yeah, I was married, had a little girl and a son on the way. I think everyone was interested in our success, but I think a little bit apprehensive. My wife, no doubt, was the most supportive of all. For whatever reason, she just thought this is probably.
She was 100% behind you during this.
She was behind it, or she hid it well that she wasn't. I'm not sure. Sure felt that way though. And, I felt like the skills I had acquired through being at the Air Force, which was a fantastic, I was in a highly competitive program, and it was just, I was lucky to be there. I felt that I had kind of put enough skills behind me that if worst came to worst, absolute worst came to worst, I could go find another job,
And spend the next 10 years paying off that $250,000
exactly.
credit card
debt. And spend a little bit of time. But, we were young, and we felt like that this was worth doing.
Good for
you.
So
give it a shot.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Alan Martin, founder and CEO of Campus Book Rentals. It's interesting because, the textbook industry has been around forever.
Yeah.
Right? People have been going to college for hundreds of years. They've needed textbooks. I guess Gutenberg was the last big innovation in that industry. And so for 200 years, really no innovation. The idea of renting textbooks just seems so obvious, certainly in hindsight. Why do you think nobody started this type of business in 1995, 10 years before you did?
I've thought a decent amount about that because it's complicated because the book industry, it's very old, and used books were probably the last innovation before rental. And so we're talking 70 years ago when someone decided, hey, people don't need to buy new books all the time. Students can sell back their old books and I'll sell the used copy to another student. And that was actually a pretty big innovation, 70 years ago or so, maybe even a little earlier than that. That was a big deal. But that was it up until now. And what's interesting, when we started in August of 2007, again, I had done as much research as I thought I could, and nobody appeared to be doing book rentals. But lo and behold, three of us began in the same month in August 2007. We had two competitors that sprung up in California, and then we sprung up in Utah, totally blind to each other. I think they're... the rental model is completely contingent on the amount of data and predictive analysis you can do on a textbook, right? I sat back in the summer of 2007 and I started writing an algorithm. As crude as it might have looked, I had to get an idea of what I believed that book was going to be worth as much as I could find out about its past. I feel like data might not have been there to pull off a successful rental model until about the time we did it,
You bring up a good point, which is, there's nobody out there in this space. And now all of a sudden, in the same month, bizarrely, three of you pop up. And it's amazing how competitive these things are, right? If you have a six-month advantage, you're really fortunate. And you've got to move quick and you've got to be aggressive in order to take advantage of it. And then each of you probably had your own bumps in the road, right? One of your competitors is Chegg. I know they just went public like 6 months ago. We'll circle back and talk about them later. But I want to talk about these bumps in the road because no company makes it through their journey without having some very stressful evening saying, wow, are we going to make it through this? Tell us about a couple of the bigger bumps in the road that you faced.
Yeah, happy to. It is tough because you're looking back on it, you feel so young and so naive. But again, starting a business, you just can't anticipate all the things coming at you. You know, both of the biggest bumps in the road that we faced came from the same type of event, although in a different context. This is the example. In the first one, we had a credit card processor. We're an online business, right? So we have a relationship with someone who's willing to accept credit cards on our behalf. A student, you know, punches in their credit card number online. That doesn't go directly to our bank account, nor does it for any company really in the world. It goes through a credit card processor. They verify the funds, and they pass that back on to the business. And that's just how the world works. Well, so we had a single credit card processor, and they had been watching us through 2008 and then in 2009, and we were a small company, but we were starting to build a lot of momentum. And by the fall of 2009, back to school season, you know, we went from doing, you know, maybe $1,000 a day in revenue or $1,500 or something to like $80,000 a day. Now, this spike threw all the fraud filters available at this credit card processor. And although we were taking all the orders because the student's money was being accepted, the credit card processor was refusing to release that to our bank account because they couldn't quite understand what we were doing.
So your website wasn't shut down. Students could still order books. You just couldn't you didn't have access to the funds.
Didn't have access to the funds. Now, this is pretty complicated when we're then in needing to buy books and fulfill these and send these books to students, right?
So time to break out some more credit card offers.
It got a little crazy, right? So they pretty much brought our business to a halt in August of 2009. We had to totally change the availability of books on our website. We had to change pricing so that students wouldn't really they'd be a little bit discouraged from shopping from us. But the lesson was we had concentrated our risk around one credit card processor. Someone sitting behind a desk, all they had to do is hit F8 or something, and that was it. No more money was coming to our account, and it pretty much shut us down for the fall of 2009. Now, once they verified that we were legitimate and all that stuff, they'd released the funds, but by then, our back-to-school season had sailed past us.
Right. So, and these are pretty, as you mentioned, time-sensitive deliveries, right? The student starts a class on a certain day, and he wants his book before that certain day.
That's right.
And I know I've read where you've talked about this before. You were able to fulfill most of those orders by the deadline when the student needed the textbook, but you did have like a third or a fourth of them that you weren't able to. They were a week or 10 days late. And I think the approach you took was really powerful with those folks is you sent them a personal email and fessed up to the problem. Hey, here's what happened. I know I've inconvenienced you. Sorry about that.
Yeah. So that was it was actually a secondary event where the exactly 1 year later in August of 2010, we were shipping more orders than ever, record-breaking amounts of orders. And we had all of those books shipping from a single supplier. So unlike the 2009 event, we had all of the money shipping, moving through a single credit card processor, which was high concentration, high risk in 2010. We had all of our books shipping through a single supplier who decided completely on their own to stop doing business with us without letting us know. So yes, we had promised a lot of students a lot of books. From our end, it looked like they were fulfilled, but indeed they were not. And these books were not arriving at houses. And so we did. We got creative. We stayed up for about 72 hours and put together some technology to match with another supplier. And we got a portion of those books, over half of them, delivered to the students that were left in the cold due to this bad supply relationship, I guess.
And here's what makes entrepreneurship so hard, right? While you're dealing with this, which is a potentially life-changing event for your company, you're also out fundraising.
Yeah.
And things are going pretty well for you. You're about to raise a pretty big round when this third-party provider cuts you off. So not only during the day are you dealing with how do I get textbooks to the students that have made orders, but in the evenings and on the weekends, you're dealing with investors who are thinking about writing a pretty big check for you. Yeah. How did you balance that? And tell her, first off, the check size, you ended up raising about $11 million in that round. So that was a really important event to fund your company and keep you relevant in an increasingly competitive, and it was kind of a winner-take-all field. You needed to grow. How did you balance that? I mean, that's most folks couldn't do that.
It was pretty tricky. And just to give some context there, we had been working for months to raise this financing, and we were 3 days away from closing when the supplier shut us down and we had all those thousands upon thousands upon thousands of students that now didn't have their books. So we thought that A, the customer base is going to hate us, and B, our investors are going to have lost faith in us. We will have lost credibility. But yeah, again, we kind of took all measures we could to make students happy, and you know, the investment closed perfectly on time. The approach that we took,
which is amazing, right? Because these are institutional investors.
They're really
doing their due diligence, research. It's about finding the next big winner, right?
Yeah.
Which is what they saw in you.
Yeah.
But it's also about mitigating your risk, and the risk meters must have been going off the charts for them at that time.
Certainly must have been, you know, that they looked at it and said, look, you guys handled it as well as you could have, put a new supply chain in place in a relatively short order and fessed up as perfectly, as honestly as we could to every single student. And, you know, it just turned out okay.
So in hindsight, it ended up being a positive for them. They got to see, how do you navigate something difficult?
If I were to invest in a company, I would love to watch them in the same situation we were in, because that was completely the biggest, event of our lives up to that point. Yeah.
So we were talking earlier about it's kind of a winner-take-all market. It's a first-mover advantage. Unfortunately, there were three first movers that started in the same month. One of your big competitors that's extremely well-funded is Chegg. Talk to us about how do you compete with them, and how has that competition evolved over the years?
So they were big competitors. I mean, in the time that we raised, $11 million, Chegg had raised nearly $200 million, and they were only raising more. So our other competitor in that same time frame had raised about $60 million. So we were by a mile the lightest funded competitor in this space. But our vision for the industry was different from day one. As early as 2008, we knew that we wanted to align ourselves with the college bookstore. If we could put our technologies inside the college store and help them rent books to students, that would be a massive win for students, because the bookstore is so convenient. It's on campus. It has all the right content. It just had bad pricing, and it had lost market share to Amazon the decade prior because pricing was bad. We saw a future for us where we would have aligned ourselves with the college bookstore and enabled them to just win market share like crazy.
So that was part of your vision from day one, was eventually we're going to align ourselves with the campus bookstores, because early on, I'm sure the bookstores didn't like you at all.
Yeah, March 2008 is when we had decided that the bookstore was the place to be. So it wasn't from, August 2007, the earliest days, but within, just a few months of that, we knew that the bookstore was the place to actually win in this market.
And how's that going for you?
Really, really well. If you look today, over half of our revenue comes from the college store market. But it was complicated, because certainly the bookstore saw us as the enemy. They had just been beaten up by Amazon, and now there's a new, set of rental companies.
Somebody's making it even cheaper by renting.
Even cheaper. Right? This is just really, really painful. And people thought we were out of our minds too, because the online was just a rocket ship, right? It was growing so quickly. And so for us to be spending our R&D dollars on bookstore technology looked really, really backwards.
But see, I agree with you, though. I think that relationship is where the value is going to be.
Absolutely.
Added, right? Because this online, folks can get into the rental industry. And, I looked online with one of my old textbooks when I was in business school, Professor Van Horn. He's got this corporate finance book that I highly suggest to anybody interested in corporate finance. Still out there. You can spend $100, you can buy it, or you can go to Campus Book Rentals and get it for $25. Mm-hmm. Your competitors are all kind of around the same price. That's going to get highly competitive. Mm-hmm. But the bookstores probably only want to have one relationship. So if you can be in the first mover there and lock up those relationships, I think you'll be a long-term player.
Absolutely. And students appreciate it too. I mean, even if it costs a few dollars more to get it on campus, they know they got the right book. They got it on time because it's in their hands immediately. And it's just a win for students as well. So,
how hard of a sell was that for the bookstores?
The first one was interesting. We knew this was going to be complicated. Now, I had graduated from Weber State, but I certainly had no ties there. But Weber State was the most obvious one to go pitch this to, first of all. And, rather than just going in and trying to explain this to them, I found a lady that was willing to go to the store, take pictures of the bookstore, and then render the whole thing in a drawing. And we had her draw in our kiosks. We use touchscreen kiosks that we put inside the store. They're branded as the store's brand. Our name doesn't show up anywhere, and we consume the bookstore's catalog via, right into this kiosk, kind of like Redbox, and
right.
The students are able to work on it. So we had her do a rendering of that very bookstore, drew the kiosks in, lines of students at the kiosk, And this, it was about, you know, this big, maybe 18 inches across and whatever. And so we went into this meeting with the bookstore, and before we said really anything, we just slid the rendering across the table.
Right.
And we just said, this is what we want to do for your store. You're the good guy, and you're bringing students back. You're going to win market share if you bring rental to your campus, I promise. And they said yes.
Yeah, they said yes relatively quickly, or was that? It
took a couple weeks, but that was just.
But not.
I think that they were fairly convinced early on that this was a direction that made sense.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. You know, I think, you know, as CEO of the company and as the visionary, being able to tell your story in a compelling story-like manner and helping people visualize it like the bookstore. I love the fact that you took the time to do this rendering, because really, you didn't need to do that. You could have said, hey, just imagine Redbox in your bookstore. Mm-hmm. But by taking the time where they could see it, the light clicked, and they said, yeah, this is something we wanted to do. So Weber State was the first.
They were basically the first one in the country to bring rental at any scale at all to the brick and mortar store.
And now how many campus bookstores have your kiosk or offer your services?
So in general, I'll back up. Almost every bookstore today rents textbooks. It became a force that they just simply could not do without.
And they either developed technology themselves.
They either developed it themselves
or they partnered
with other people that ultimately looked at our model and said, this works. So we work with a few hundred bookstores today. It represents about 15% of the entire college market where they have experience with our technology inside the store.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Alan Martin, founder and CEO of Campus Book Rentals. I want to stay on this theme of competition, because it's not, unfortunately, not only do you just have other competitors like Chegg, but then you also have kind of the evolution of the industry. And I think we can all see a day where most textbooks are going to be digital. How do you position yourself today so that you can be relevant when that transition takes place?
Yeah, this is the biggest question that we've had to answer from day one, right? In 2007, people promised this would be out of business by 2010. And that conversation has continued, right? And we had a little different sensibility on the market. We view it basically this way, and an analogy is probably best. If we look at Netflix, which we think is a relevant comp to what we do, the reason that Netflix exists digitally today and the reason that they stream video today is because they formed relationships with millions of households through the physical DVD, because people had DVD players. They didn't have bandwidth to stream, so they gave them the product that would work for them, and they formed a relationship, and then they just were able to just turn that right into a digital relationship.
So is it the relationship with the consumer, who's in 4 years going to be out of college, or is it the relationship with the bookstore, who in 4 years is still going to be selling textbooks?
In our view, it's the relationship with the college bookstore, with the institution. So we have a belief that the bookstore is going to remain an influencer of content on campus. Now, there's another theory that could say college bookstores go away. We think the relationships are very unique between the college bookstore and university professors.
It's a profit center for most universities, isn't it?
It is a profit center. It's a brand center. It's just an important thing for
students
to have.
It's part of the community.
It is. It's a very important environment, and we think it's going to be there for a long time. So our view is that, you know, we've watched a lot of companies who have developed digital technologies, and they just assumed that people, because they were reading novels digitally, were ready to jump into textbooks digitally. They were wrong about that, and many people have been, and we've watched.
The stakes are really high with your textbooks, right? I mean, these are your grades. This is your opportunity for a job when you get out.
That's right.
And the way you read a textbook and make sure that you learn the information, we're all different, right? I was a highlighter. I'd write in my textbook. I don't know how I would manage that in a digital format. I'm sure kids are going to figure it out, but it is very different. I completely agree.
It's different, and students have you know, not chosen digital for years and years and years now because there's so much at stake. They're going to do what works for them. So, yeah, our view, at some point, digital is going to get so good that students just have to use it, or it's going to get so cheap that they can't refuse it. You know what I mean? Something is going to happen.
But you'll have the relationship with the bookstore.
We believe that we will have the relationship with the bookstore long term. Yeah.
You know, one of the things I was surprised at, and I hope I'm correct, your only distribution center is in Ogden.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That's right. We have 60,000 feet in Ogden, and that's our distribution center. That's right.
And if I'm correct, your competitor, Chegg, is in Kentucky, which sounds as illogical as Utah, until people realize that UPS's headquarters is based in Kentucky. Now, all of a sudden, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Why have your distribution center in Utah as opposed to Memphis, Tennessee, where FedEx is headquartered?
Yeah, we've weighed this many times. And, you know, what we've concluded, the talent thus far that we've found is in Utah. And Utah actually is not as bad as it sounds. We have contracts with the USPS. And we innovated some processes for the USPS. Our chief logistics guy, he actually won the National Mail Innovations Award. I mean, the top award for the post office awarded by the Postmaster General, where they did custom packaging, flat rates, two-day shipping across the entire United States for us. This is both going and coming from the facility. So we made Utah work by innovating the USPS, and that allowed us to get a lot of bandwidth out of Utah. Now, as we grow, it's very likely that we will duplicate and have a secondary facility back east.
Well, good for the U.S. Post Office that they're your primary provider. It's
they
good
are
to
now.
Hear that they're able
yeah.
to compete and they're able to do that. I noticed in some of your older literature that every time somebody rented a book from you, your company made a donation to Operation Smile.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys still do that?
Yep, we do. That still happens. And so we've, I don't know the figure and probably wouldn't share it even if I had it, but but we do. We have a good relationship with Operation Smile. We've had the chance to have the founder herself come visit us in person and talk to the company. And
tell us about that group, what they do and why they're important to you.
Yeah, so they fix basically cleft lips all around the world. So these kids that have, you know, big facial defects and troubles eating and everything like that would basically be shunned, you know, in the places where they go. It's just it's a really, you know, those kids get a really raw deal.
It's a travesty, and it's
really for the whole family, not just the kid.
Yeah, and it's really very little money to fix it. I've got a friend who adopted a child that had a cleft lip, and you know, without. And I forget what the sum is, but it's very low. It's like
about
$100. $200.
Every $250 we donate, you know, guarantees a surgery.
Completely changes that child's life. Then.
It totally changes the entire trajectory of that kid's life. So as we looked, it's like, you know, we could do things with reading or something that felt like it had an educational angle. But it was one of the very early members of the team. His wife had mentioned Operation Smile. You guys should look at it. And we had heard about it because in Utah, you know, it's out there enough. And the minute we looked at it, we said, this is just the right thing to do.
And so my final question to you is really, is this journey what you thought it was going to be when you started racking up all your credit card debt and took the big gamble in 2007? What's been the best part and what's been the biggest surprise, positive or negative of it?
I think one of the most startling realizations for me, and I think other members of the team too, is that what looks to be very mysterious from the outside, people see success and it just looks really mysterious and hard to do. In a lot of ways, it's from a time perspective, it's hard. It's not as complicated and not as mysterious as people think. You know, I felt like just the most normal college kid in the world, and I think our whole team felt that way. But we did this thing, and I think we were quiet, we listened, we were curious, and we just kept working, and we just did it. People yeah. rarely quiet down and rarely get curious, but I think if they did, you know.
You know, oftentimes the difference between entrepreneurs, folks that do start a company and folks that don't, is just people that have the courage to take that first step.
Yeah.
And I also love, you used two words earlier, you were curious and you listened. Mm-hmm. And I think those are really important traits for a successful entrepreneur. Alan, thank you for joining us today. I enjoyed our chat.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Our guest this morning has been Alan Martin, CEO and founder of Campus Book Rentals. This show was recorded at KCPW Studios on Library Square. It was produced by Ross Chambliss with technical support by Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm Doug Wells. Join us next week on The Bottom Line.